WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. Playwright Sam Shepard was described in Esquire magazine as creating quintessential American characters in the idioms of rock, sci-fi, and the Wild West. As an actor, Shepard starred in such films as The Right Stuff, Crimes of the Heart, Steel Magnolias, Country, and Terrence Malick's Days of Heaven. He wrote the screenplay for Paris, Texas. His plays include Fool for Love, True West, and Buried Child, which won a Pulitzer Prize in 1979. His new collection of short stories, Great Dream of Heaven, has just been published. In the past, Shepard has written about his fear of flying, which not only goes against his iconic image, it's a stark contrast to his portrayal of test pilot Chuck Yeager in The Right Stuff.
Say there, Yeager.
Sir?
We were just talking to Slick here about the sound barrier.
Is that right?
And we feel that the X-1 is ready to have a go at it.
We think the X-1's got the answer to go beyond Mach 1.
If there is any beyond. So what do you think, Yeager?
Well, I'll tell you what, half these engineers never been off the ground, you know. I mean, they're liable to tell you that the sound barrier is a brick wall in the sky. It'll rip your ears off if you try to go through it. If you ask me, I don't believe the damn thing even exists.
Waitress, a drink from Mr. Yeager here.
No, thanks, I got one.
So, do you think you want to have a go at it?
I might.
But since, as you say, this sound barrier doesn't really exist, how much
you got? I'm just joking. The Air Force is paying me already. Ain't that right, sir?
Well, sure, Yeager, but...
So when do we go?
Sam Shepard spoke with Terry Gross in 1998.
I got to meet Chuck Yeager, you know, when I was shooting The Right Stuff. And he's a man who's known for impeccable courage and all the rest of it. And I got to talking to him about flying and all that, and he says it's not true that you don't have fear. You know, fear is part and parcel of the thing that you take on. It's that you're able to face it. You know, to me, that's the interesting part about courage. You know, it's not that you don't have fear; it's that you look it in the eye. You know.
But Chuck Yeager went on to be, a famous test pilot. You played him in The Right Stuff, but you don't go up in planes yourself, right?
I do occasionally. Yeah, I'm getting better at it. Actually, I go to Mexico once a year and stuff like that. It's just that I'm not crazy about it, you know. And it's a funny thing because I grew up in a kind of rural situation, and most of the people that I've talked to from that kind of background are terrified of flying, and I was. Thought that was curious, you know, the people who had a background of being sort of stuck in the land don't like to get up in airplanes, and I don't know if that's just a coincidence or you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm,
I mean,
mm-hmm.
I have a farmer friend of mine who once a year flies to Las Vegas to have a go at the one-armed bandits, and he can't stand airplanes. He hates them. But he goes, you know?
Now, did playing Chuck Yeager have any effect on you and flying?
Any effect on me and flying? No, I went up with him actually once in a little Piper Cub over the desert because I thought, you know, if I'm going to crash, I might as well go down with the world's greatest pilot. So we went to this hangar, and he took this little hook that was like a looked like an umbrella handle and pulled this airplane out of the hangar by hand. And it was a single-prop plane. We jumped in the damn thing and took off, and I couldn't believe it. I felt great. It was a great feeling. We kind of hovered over the desert, and he showed me different stuff, you know, where he hung out in his Air Force days. And that was fun.
Now, I know your father was a bomber pilot in World War II. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if that had any impact on you. And if you
I'm sure it did.
Did you hear a lot of scary stories about nearly being shot down during the war?
Well, he had quite a few scrapes. He had a bunch of shrapnel hit him and stuff. And one time they had a belly gunner, you know, in those old big planes. They had these glass turrets underneath the fuselage with the machine gun turret, and one of his buddies was in that while he was flying the bomber, and the turret got shot off, and he saw his pal go down, you know, stuff like that. I don't know. I guess it gives you the little nightmares when you're a kid and stuff. I suppose it does. It has affected me, but I'm not sure how.
What effect do you think it has on your career? You know, a lot of people, especially those who don't live in L.A.
The fear of flying in my career?
Yeah, because...
Is that what you're...
Yeah, because, you know, if you're an actor and you don't live in L.A., well, you know, you fly there when you get the part.
Oh,
but if you
I
don't
see.
Like
I
to fly,
mean,
it's really a burden to get there, particularly on short notice or to go back
and
forth.
You
know, a lot of people like bi-coastal, always flying back and forth between New York and L.A. You've got plays in New York and movie jobs in L.A. And
yeah, it slows things down, but I enjoy driving. In fact, I just drove to British Columbia to do a film and got stuck in that big blizzard in South Dakota coming back. But it was kind of neat. You know, I stayed 2 days in Wyoming and Sheridan and Gillette, you know, while the winds were blowing 50 miles an hour, and it was kind of interesting.
Now, some of your plays have dealt with family upheaval, family violence. You left your family as a teenager. You left home.
I did. I was driven out.
driven out by your parents?
Well, that's unfair to say. I mean, I left in a kind of holocaust of my old man. You know, he destroyed the house, and I decided it was time to go.
What did your father do that destroyed the house?
What did he do?
Yeah.
Broke windows, tore the doors off, stuff like that.
Oh, literally destroyed the house?
Yeah, physically.
Huh. How did your mother handle that? She didn't run away with you.
She's a very brave soul.
Was your father very strict when you were growing up? Were there a lot of rules you were supposed to follow? What were the rules?
He was an Air Force guy, you know.
Right.
Crew cut and all that stuff.
So what were the rules you were supposed to obey as a kid?
What were the rules I was supposed to be? Never show any feeling. Was one of the rules.
Now, I think there's a kind of hard-boiled quality about some of your characters, so that even if they don't kind of openly express a lot of emotion, they're also vulnerable, but in a hard-boiled way, as opposed to in a way where they don't express emotion, but you know, behind closed doors, they'd be crying or something. Do you know what I mean? And I'm wondering if you thought of yourself as having that hard-boiled quality when you were still in the house with your parents, kind of in a house ruled by your father?
No, I never, as a kid, thought of myself as hard-boiled. That came later.
Mm-hmm.
Under the influence of my old man and the family situation and all that, I never for a second believed that I was that tough, you know? You can't, as a child, you don't think of yourself as tough. I mean, you may be able to bear certain things, but I just never had that kind of image of myself as a tough kid.
When your father was tearing doors off hinges and breaking windows, was he beating you up too?
Now and then, you know. Yeah. But I mean, I wouldn't say that I had a particularly horrendous childhood compared to the modern kids. You know, I think the modern kids probably have it worse, you know, having sometimes no fatherly influence at all, you know.
Sam Shepard talking with Terry Gross in 1998. He has a new collection of short stories. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry Gross's interview with Sam Shepard, recorded in 1998.
When you were young, did you find any resonance in books or movies, you know, with the situation that you were in? Did you gravitate to books or movies that seemed to describe family similar to yours? Or did you look for something completely different in books and movies?
Well, no, I was, it was funny, when I was in high school, again, we were out in the middle of the boondocks, you know, and there was a little bitty art house theater, I remember, out in a place called Cucamonga.
Oh, wow, and you really lived in a place called near Cucamonga?
Yeah.
You remember on the Jack Benny show? It was always, the bus announcer was always singing Cucamonga.
Yeah, it really is a Cucamonga. It was surrounded by vineyards, you know, and for some reason, there was this little bitty art house theater, and they'd show foreign films, which was just unbelievable in those days because there wasn't anything around but Ben-Hur and, you know, Cleopatra and all those kind of things. So me and a couple of buddies of mine would go out there, and I saw a film called 400 Blows by Truffaut, black and white film. And that really stunned me. You know, it was like, wow, you know, this kid, I saw a lot of similarities in that between my situation and that, you know.
He sent to reform school in that.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, he had a pretty rough deal.
So you were seeing art films in Cucamonga, wow.
Yeah, art films, imagine that.
So were you seeing plays or reading plays?
No. Uh-uh. I'd read some O'Neill.
You talk about family drama.
Yeah, some of his one-act stuff. And then I saw the film based on Long Day's Journey in the Night, which I thought was an amazing film, you know, particularly since it was based on a play. I don't think most plays make good movies, but in that case, it was incredible performances. You know.
You started off acting in, I think it was a repertory company, a small repertory company that basically toured churches.
Yeah, when I first left home, I got this paper route, and I was delivering papers all the time. I had a 51 Chevy, and I was throwing papers all around the houses and stuff, and at the end of the day, I started going through this paper, and at the end of it, in the work section, there was this little ad that said, "Actors Wanted." And I went in and auditioned for this company. It was called the Bishop's Company. And the great thing about it was a traveling company. It was going to get the hell out of there, you know. So they hired me, and the next day I was on a Greyhound bus to Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and joined up with the company there. And we toured all over the place and did these one-night stands in churches, which was my first real experience with theater.
It's funny because you went, you know, from churches eventually to off-Broadway at a time when off-Broadway was, you know, very avant-garde for its time. So it's an interesting contrast. Playing the church circuit must have been an interesting way to see the country and get started acting.
Yeah, and also to see this, probably the last of that kind of 50s culture, although it was the 60s, you know, there was still a 50s feel about it, you know, that culture in small-town America. It was pretty amazing.
So you went to New York, I think it was in 1963.
Yeah.
What was it like to be, I think you were living or at least working in Greenwich Village. Was this your first exposure to an avant-garde and to a bohemian life, to a life that was radically different from the kind of military life that you grew up in and also radically different from the churches that you were touring?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was. I was suddenly on the Lower East Side on Avenue C and 10th Street living with jazz musicians.
Well, I think your roommate was Charles Mingus's son.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd gone to high school with him, and he was working at a place called the Village Gate, and got me a job there as a busboy. So that's how I got initiated into New York.
Were you a good busboy?
Oh, yeah, excellent. I got fired, though, because I dropped knocked over a candle on a guy's suit. And that was the end of that job.
Right, right.
But in the course of that, I got to see probably the most amazing musicians of their time, you know, like the Adderley Brothers and Mingus and Thelonious Monk and Jerry Mulligan. It was just a free show, you know.
Yeah, because the Village Gate was a club.
Yeah, yep.
In the 60s, everybody wrote about you as, like, the new bright hope of off-Broadway. What was off-Broadway like when you started writing plays for off-Broadway?
Well, obviously, it was so poverty-stricken that they had to pick on me. You know? I don't really know anything about off-Broadway at that time because I didn't try to. You know, it was commercial in its own way as Broadway was. You know, it was as forbidding as Broadway as far as opening the door to it. And I just was lucky in the fact that all of these little cafes and churches and stuff were starting to open up to, you know, a brand new way of theater.
Did you want to act in your own plays? Did you see that as
no.
a possibility for yourself? Why not?
I don't know. It seems like the height of vanity to me, you know, acting and writing and direct. You know what I mean? I just it's embarrassing.
And that's what kept you from doing it, thinking I was vain?
Yeah, in some ways, I suppose. Of course, that's kind of vain, too, to think that. But, you know, it was just... And the other side of it, too, is that I kind of like seeing the writing from the outside. I like seeing an actor play it.
Uh-huh.
Where I don't think you can really see the writing if you're inside it.
Do you, when you're writing lines for a play, do you speak the lines out loud to just hear how they sound
sometimes.
Spoken?
Sometimes, yeah.
Now, when you're writing dialogue for a play, do you ever hear a certain musicality in a line, like where you hear the accent, where you hear the emphasis is being, and then the actor does it completely different for differently than that? And
oh, yeah.
And maybe it works, but maybe it doesn't work for you. Maybe you feel like your intention was kind of lost. Will you say something to the actor about that if you do feel that the music you're hearing is lost?
Well, yeah, but I think more often, particularly if you have good actors like, for instance, Malkovich and Ed Harris and Jim Gammon and these great actors that I've had the good fortune to get, they often will land things in an unexpected way that's not only surprising but right. You know, I mean, much more right than you could have intended. You know, in other words, they bring the intention of the writing into another dimension, in another domain. Malkovich has an uncanny ability to do that.
Any general impressions about most screenplays that you read now about how well they're written?
Oh boy. Well, my main problem with screenplays nowadays, you know, that most of the ones I've seen is that there are no characters whatsoever in them. That's my main problem. You just don't find any characters. You find these formulas.
Uh-huh.
You find these sort of Hollywood rituals going on, but you don't find characters. Every once in a while you do. I mean, I don't want to be too harsh. But many, many of the characters don't even feel human. They feel computerized or faxed or, you know, somebody's mailed it in. And they all kind of sound like the same, they come from the same person. I don't know if it's a secretary out there who's doing it or what.
That's the secret.
Very weird, you know.
You must be able to read screenplays with confidence because you write plays. I mean, I know, like for me, for instance, it's very hard for me to read a play or a screenplay and really be able to kind of stage in my mind how it would look and sound together.
Well, screenplays are easier to read because if you can't get past the first five pages, you might as well throw it in the fire, you know? That's it. Five pages.
Well, I really want to thank you a lot for talking with us about your life and your work. Appreciate it very much.
You bet.
Playwright, actor, and director Sam Shepard. His new collection of short stories is called Great Dream of Heaven. This is Fresh Air.